I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The 2019 session is coming to an end for the Missouri General Assembly, but there's still a state budget to finalize and bills to consider. Today, a Missouri legislative update. We'll revisit the Clean Missouri Initiative, discuss a redefining of blight that could impact building project incentives here in Kansas City, and an idea aimed at protecting women from sexual assault and harassment. Then, the iconic Rodney Crowell has put together an all-star team for his new country album that chronicles his Texas roots. Hear about his tour coming to Kansas City and the musicians he's collaborated with in his long career. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. With just weeks to go in the 2019 session, the Missouri General Assembly is hard at it, considering bills that will impact a lot of people in this state, from reconsidering the Clean Missouri Good Government Initiative that voters passed in November, to reconsidering how colleges and universities deal with accusations of sexual harassment, to redefining blight, which would impact incentives given to developers. There's a whole lot going on here. With us to talk about the big issues here today are Samuel King. He's a Missouri reporter for KCUR. Sam, nice to have you.
Yeah, good morning, Steve.
Also with us is Kevin Corlew, who's a lawyer and a former Republican state representative from Kansas City. Kevin, nice to have you back as well. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
You know, Kevin, you've covered a lot of these legislative sessions. You've been involved in so many of them. This one seems like it doesn't have a specific focus, dominated by a couple of big issues. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah, I think you're right. Some of the big issues that we've dealt with over the last few years, whether it be transportation, education, just some of the big ones you see recurring, they're still there, but they haven't really taken the focus. It's been kind of an issue here, an issue there. It doesn't seem like there has been a real focus or an agenda as we've seen in the past.
Sam, let's turn to Clean Missouri. This is the ethics package that voters approved just last November. House Republicans are asking Missourians to vote again on the Clean Missouri Initiative. This has to do primarily with the drawing of legislative districts. I mean, why do Republicans want to go back to this issue all over again here, Samuel?
Well, Steve, the House debated this last week, and one thing we heard over and over again from them was that Clean Missouri passed in part because there was tons of dollars from billionaires referencing George Soros trying to shove it down people's throats. They say their proposal would actually have a chance to be vetted in the legislature and over the next year and a half before the 2020 election. And they also accused the supporters of Clean Missouri of trying to hide ethics reform measures that are popular, like a gift limit on lobbyist gifts in a package with redistricting reform, sort of like, okay, here's this nice stuff that you like, but right, here's this sort of thing that you might not understand and might not know about, but we're going to put it in here anyway because we want to get rid of gerrymandering.
Okay. And how different, again, Sam, just remind us, Samuel, how different is the Republican package from what voters approved in November?
Well, on the redistricting in particular, Amendment 1 does require the state auditor to perform to appoint a nonpartisan demographer. Currently, the state auditor, of course, is a Democrat. That demographer would then draw the new maps primarily based on partisan fairness,
right,
and competitiveness. The Republican proposal would get rid of the state demographer position. They say it would actually be a partisan demographer, to use your phrasing, and that would move partisan fairness and competitiveness down on the list of criteria. Not getting rid of it completely, but making sure the old criteria of compactness and contiguousness and all of that would still be at the top of the list instead of kind of where it is right now under Amendment 1.
And Samuel, you're saying that the Republican package goes beyond redistricting. It also includes gifts and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would include a complete ban on lobbyist gifts, not just a $5 limit, or what some call a cup of coffee rule. Like Republicans are saying, okay, why not? Let's just go farther than that. Let's just get rid of the gifts altogether.
Kevin Corlew, you've served down there. What do you make of this notion that Republicans want to go right back to the well again with voters, maybe later this year, just months after they approved this thing overwhelmingly?
Well, I do think it's important, Steve, to point out, as you have mentioned, but it's important to emphasize that whatever the legislature does come up with, it does have to go back to the voters. So, you know,
there's a
phrase that's used, you know, as far as undermining the voters and things like that. But keep in mind that everything will go back to the voters. And I think there is a sense, and there's an argument to be had that the Republicans are making that what was put out before the voters really emphasized those other issues, the lobbying issues and such, that really nobody had, trouble with. But, packed within there was this complete new redistricting type of issue. And so they want to at least look at, vet it, you know, bring up another proposal, and then let the voters look at that and weigh in on it.
Kevin, if we cut through all this, help me here. The real fear on the Republican side is that these changes to redistricting will heavily favor Democrats, and they want to nip this in the bud before it goes into effect.
You know, certainly there are partisan arguments to be had on either side of this issue. And it's not too long ago that the state house was controlled by Democrats, within the last generation. So the pendulum does swing, but I think probably the more overriding issue is let's have a redistricting process that not only is fair, but also follows constitutional law. What was put out there, that now an amendment that was just voted on, will inevitably result in some very strange looking districts if the main focus that you're doing is based on partisan issues of 50-50 50% Democrats, 50% Republicans. So I think ultimately they're trying to look for a process that's fair, a process that is not partisan. Keep in mind that the process that we had before for state legislatures was a nonpartisan process. It was drawn either by a panel that was made up of even Republicans and Democrats, and if they couldn't agree, then it went to the judges, nonpartisan judges. The system that has been proposed under the amendment voted in by the people is done by although it's called the nonpartisan demographer, it's appointed by a partisan position. So, that's that argument to be had.
Kevin, let me go to Samuel King from KCUR. What do we know about what Democrats are saying about this?
Well, they're concerned that just months after voters overwhelmingly approved Amendment 1, there's going to be another decision about this, another potential vote that Republicans are bringing it up. They feel that voters spoke pretty clearly about what they wanted in Amendment 1. They did raise some issue, to put it mildly, with some of the implications that some of the House representatives were making on the floor about sort of did voters know what they were voting for. And they said, clearly, even in very Republican districts that are represented by Republicans across the state, people did go ahead and vote for Amendment 1. Also in the House, including one Democrat, Judy Morgan, who represents Kansas City in the House of Representatives, one of many, she was raising the point that sort of this bill, this particular bill, or particular piece of legislation, because it's a joint resolution, was brought up in committee. They did what they call a committee substitute. First, it was just the ban on lobbyist gifts, and then in this committee, they brought up the wholesale changes that have been in some other legislation. Mm-hmm. They feel it was a bit of a bait and switch, that the changes were added in committee without the chance for real input and vetting. And that's something the Clean Missouri side has been saying too. But, Republicans are saying, look, we're getting a chance to vet this if we do it here in the House and once again in the Senate.
Samuel, is there any question that the Clean Missouri package as it stands today would help Democrats in the future? The AP, the Associated Press, has taken a look at this, I think concluded that, yes, in fact, it looks like Democrats would be advantaged.
Yeah, Democrats would sort of gained seats in their analysis that they did, probably not, you know, depending on how things were, because, you, again, you never know what's going to happen in the future, probably not to maybe take the majority in either the House or the Senate. But they would definitely gain seats under the new redistricting plan. And another concern that some people have raised about the existing plan, if it does go to the judges, that process isn't always necessarily transparent. If the commission can't agree on maps and it has to go to the judges can kind of do their thing and then bring out the maps. So they're the people who supported Amendment 1 saying, you know, this really does bring it out to the public as well.
Kevin, what's your best guess if this goes back to the voters? Are they likely to reverse course and approve what the Republicans are offering? Because, frankly, I have a hard time seeing that.
I don't think there's a clear answer to that at this point. I don't know. I think it matters in terms of if it's put out there before the people, what type of campaign is run, what type of information is run. And I think that's one of the arguments to go ahead and get it done in terms of the legislation to put it on the ballot, get it done this session so that there can be adequate time for both sides to really make their case before the voters before 2020.
Again, we should point out that this is passed the House, Samuel, but it sure hasn't passed the Senate. And there are some questions there whether the Senate will what they'll do with this.
And still, in terms of the House, Steve, they're still waiting for that final, what they call third reading. They perfected it, as they call it, which gives it initial approval.
Right.
They're supposed to do that in the House on Thursday. Everyone's expecting that. And the majority floor leader said, oh, OK, we can just leave for the weekend. And that kind of surprised people. So we're going to see, because there has been quite the pushback from people about that. And then in the Senate, again, you know, there are some similar bills there. Those have not moved out of committee. Mm-hmm. They're probably waiting on this House bill. We'll see if there's time for them to get to it.
Let's turn to a different issue, and that's blight. The General Assembly is considering this other bill that would make it tougher for developers to build projects using TIF, that's tax increment financing, that's been so commonly used in Kansas City. Like a lot of folks in our town, some lawmakers have gotten frustrated with incentives being used in affluent areas like the Plaza. Now, this issue is a big one in the ongoing race for Kansas City mayor. What more do we know what lawmakers are looking at here, Samuel? What can you fill us in there?
Well, one bill sponsored by Senator Andrew Koenig of the St. Louis County area would definitely tighten the sort of definition of blight. People have long complained that the definition currently in Missouri law to what constitutes a blighted area and where development can be put, that would tighten, sort of put more definition on whether this area is truly blighted. Koenig told me a few weeks ago that, you know, a lot of, particularly in his region, there are a lot of tax increment financing or TIF districts in affluent areas, affluent suburbs that maybe don't necessarily meet the criteria for blight. Maybe they might, for whatever reason, it might be an area that's difficult for developers to develop, but that's doesn't necessarily mean it's a blighted area. It would also sort of limit the use of what TIFs are used in terms of retail establishments. One thing that Koenig talked about in the St. Louis region, where you have a lot of municipalities close to each other, that maybe a Walmart or Schnucks moves down the road, not far geographically, but you're in a different jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So these municipalities are trying to use tax incentives to get these sorts of things to move, but not really adding jobs.
Senator Koenig just said this: too often we've been doing TIF in areas where it's not needed. It needs to be used in areas where investment otherwise would not happen. That's been a big issue. Again, that very point's been a big issue in the race for Kansas City mayor. Kevin Corlew, why does the state feel the need to move in here? Why not just leave this issue to municipalities?
Well, it is probably an issue that should be best determined at the municipal level, especially if it's dealing with municipal type TIFs. But, you know, there sometimes has been an overriding effort to take a look at tax incentives and to make sure that they're being used judiciously. I think that probably this maybe becomes the proverbial hammer, and in terms of, instead of trying to look at the real specific areas that are problematic for TIFs and for other tax incentives, it's a state kind of overreaching and trying to control things. I think that, as you mentioned, here in Kansas City, we need to have a continual discussion as far as where TIF should be used and what increment financing is appropriate.
Right.
But really, the people on the ground, on those TIF commissions, the people in the communities, they're probably in the best position to determine whether it should be used appropriately in that area or not.
Samuel Kane, could this thing pass?
Well, the Koenig's bill has already passed the Senate, and you had sort of an interesting coalition of people who are supporting sort of this issue in both chambers. Koenig is a conservative Republican, part of the conservative caucus in the Senate. They don't like tax incentives at all. They feel a lot of them amount to sort of corporate welfare, and you have some from Democrats who feel that the TIF process has left some areas that really need areas out. So it's in a House committee this afternoon. Like I said, it's already passed the Senate, so we'll see whether it comes up in the House before the end of the session.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about some of the big issues that Missouri lawmakers are facing just weeks before their final adjournment for the 2019 session. You know, Kevin Corlew, lawmakers are also looking at what some have called one very strict abortion bill. It's referred to as a heartbeat measure. It bans abortions as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. Why is this being looked at by lawmakers this session?
Well, I think what you're seeing here in Missouri is not unlike what you're seeing in other states.
Yes.
throughout the nation, and that is the abortion issue has become front and center again. You know, we've discussed it for years, obviously, but with the change in the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, I think there's a sense that some of these pro-life measures could eventually make it up to the U.S. Supreme Court and give the justices another chance to take a look at the Roe v. Wade, you know, history and perhaps overturn some of that. And so I think that's why it's become front and center here in Missouri as well as other states.
Oh, why would so many states be considering very similar measures, Kevin? Is there an interest group out there that's really pushing this idea out to all the states right now?
Well, you do often see model legislation that has come up in other states. I'm not sure of this particular one. I guess I'm not on the, you know, on the inside of this to see where,
right,
where this came from. But yeah, you do often see if there's a movement, you know, on some issue, that what one state has done, others will pick up on that, or perhaps, you know, the same interest group will try to get it legislated in other issue in other states.
Samuel, any sense if this is going to pass?
Well, we've had the big bill that passed the House. There's a lot of support in the Senate for this legislation. They still kind of were debating whether to go with the House bill that puts a lot of anti-abortion provisions in one bill or due to separate bills. I think it'll come up. Democrats are likely going to filibuster this, so it's going to be a question of whether the Senate feels they can get done what they need to get done in time, including the budget, once it comes out of a conference committee to move this forward. So it sounded to me, speaking when the Senate Majority Leader gave a news conference on Thursday at the end of the week, it sounded like that's still a little up in the air. They want to bring it up, but whether it moves, it still would be up for debate, I think.
You know, one other hot issue this session that's gotten a lot of focus is this Title IX protections that are aimed at protecting women from sexual assault and harassment on university campuses. Kevin Corlew, why has this become an issue this session?
You know, Steve, I'm not all that knowledgeable on this particular issue, but it's once in a while you will see issues that are particularly driven by a special interest. I did not hear a lot of discussion about this issue in years past. It doesn't seem like it was an overriding issue that was really affecting the state, such as transportation or other big issues. So, this seems to be driven more particularly to a special interest group. I'm sure you've talked about some of the issues on this particular one. A lot of lobbyists were hired. And, I don't know where all that comes from. There was a story last week about one of the particular lobbyists who had a son that perhaps would have been affected.
Right.
You know, I don't know all the details of that, but this seems to be, to me, from the outside looking in, to be more of a special interest driven type of legislation as opposed to an overriding issue that needed to be addressed.
You know, Sam King, the lobbyist that Kevin Corlew is referring to, is a man named Richard McIntosh. The Star had a story on this saying that the lobbyist pushing this idea was really trying to help his son, who apparently got into trouble in connection with this issue, was expelled from school for these allegations. There's also a sense that now that this connection between McIntosh and this issue has come to the fore, that maybe the issue is fading a little bit in terms of its likelihood to pass.
Yeah, the majority leader Caleb Brown in the Senate said it's, quote, doubtful that the bill will come up again. The Senate version of the bill had already been debated on the floor. They, you know, they talked about it, had some arguments back and forth and amendments, but they saw it wasn't going anywhere, so they pulled it. So it's unlikely it's going to come back. Some of the bigger issues were with the House legislation, where more of sort of the influence was put out there. But it's interesting in all of this, the House legislation actually hadn't reached the floor yet, even though it had cleared some of the committees. So now with this sort of revelation about McIntosh's role in this and some of the questions it raises about the role of lobbyists and dark money, definitely unlikely it might come up again.
Okay. One final bill under consideration would restrict the ability of counties and other local municipalities to regulate concentrated animal feeding operations known as CAFOs, I guess. We're talking about big hog farms, Samuel, that kind of thing?
Yeah, big hog and cattle farms. And this would forbid any local government from putting tougher environmental health rules on those operations than what comes down from the state.
So this is legislation on in favor of concentrated animal feeding operations. Would this have any impact on the big cattle facility that threatens Powell Gardens?
Well, it would keep Johnson County, for instance, from implementing any regulations that are tougher than
this
the state.
Is Johnson County, Missouri,
right,
I should point
right,
out.
Right, in Johnson County, Missouri, or, you know, Jackson County, kind of, because it's close to the line. But according to the Daily Star Journal, commissioners have already put this ordinance off until 2020, and the Missouri Clean Water Commission has already reversed a ruling that would have allowed that to move forward. But this doesn't necessarily take away the ability of the state to regulate this, to come in and say, hey, we think this is a bad idea, but it would keep local governments from saying, hey, we think this is a bad idea, or if we do, you have to follow the state regulations.
Also, as we wrap this up today, breaking news out of St. Louis this morning that St. Louis County Executive Steve Steger is a target of a U.S. government investigation into political favors traded for campaign donations. He's been indicted by a federal grand jury on charges of bribery, mail fraud, and theft of honest services. He has resigned as county executive. KCUR News will have more on that later on today. I want to thank KCUR Samuel King for the good update. Samuel, always appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
And Kevin Corlew, a former Republican state representative from Kansas City. Kevin, sure appreciate your time today as well.
Thank you, Steve, for the opportunity. Always good to visit with you.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with a legend. His name is Rodney Crowell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, biographer Joan Biskupic on what has shaped the decision-making of Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice John Roberts. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. The framework for Kansas City's green spaces was laid out over 125 years ago. Tomorrow on the show, what the future holds for the city's boulevards and parks. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, at 68, Rodney Crowell can look back at a career spent with some of the greatest artists of his times, and one in which he's been credited with reshaping American music. His latest project only begins to speak to the lineup of stars he's worked with. He'll be working with Willie Nelson, Lyle Lovett, Leanne Womack, and a guy named Ringo Starr for an album of collaborations called Texas. He's about to be inducted into the Texas Country Music Hall of Fame, in part because of his contributions to the new traditionalist movement that added a dose of rock and roll to the traditional sounds of country music. Rodney Crowell is coming to the Folly Theater on Friday night as part of the Bridges Americana concert series. Before I introduce Rodney, here he is singing with Emmylou Harris. This is Hanging Up My Heart from the 2013 duet album titled Old Yellow Moon.
Well, I'm hanging up my heart in the lights in the bunkhouse. I don't want to be wounded by the wrong kind of love. No more rodeo dances. No more howling at the moonlight. I'm gonna give them up. And I'm hanging up my heart. If I were you, I'd try.
And Rodney Crowell joins us now from Nashville. Rodney, it's great to have you. Good morning.
How are you?
When you started, you know, getting inducted into halls of fame in Americana, getting Americana Lifetime Achievement Awards for songwriting and the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, that introduces a sense of introspection to one's career, I would think. You've done a lot, Rodney. How satisfied are you with all the albums and the Grammys and all the big names you've had a chance to work with over the years?
Somewhat satisfied.
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah. I subscribe to the notion that the carrot needs to remain out in front because what's most important to me is the work that I'm doing right now or the work I'm going to be doing in the few days to come. It just seems to work better for me because to rest on my laurels or to think that, you know, to take stock of what I'm doing based on what I've already done doesn't interest me as much as the discovery of what I'm going to do next.
Because if you sort of sat back, I guess it would make the process of trying to write and create maybe that much tougher?
Well, perhaps, you know, it's a way of tricking myself into not becoming satisfied.
Yeah.
Because certainly I want to continue to do good work and for it to be meaningful. And, you know, the notion of quote-unquote the oldies act going around playing the same songs over and over and over and over again would put me out of business. It's just not the way I'm wired.
You said once that the writing of songs came easier to you than the singing and performing of those songs. Why was that, do you think?
Well, for the first 50 years of my life, I had a real toxic relationship with the sound of my voice.
That'll do it.
which is tough, you know, when you're in a recording studio and you're listening back to what you've just recorded and you're going, oh, erase the guy singing. And it really wasn't until I made a record like in the end or 1999. It came out in 2001. It's called The Houston Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that I ever sat in the studio and, more importantly, heard the end result of the work and said, ooh, I sound good.
Huh.
And that was the beginning of something for me. And I progressively became a better singer from that point on. You know, maybe it's a thing about self-acceptance. And, you know, the work I've done since then, I stand behind, you know, steadfastly.
That's interesting because, like, in the radio business, when most people first begin, they always recoil when they hear the sound of their voice. And then a week later or 2 weeks later, they don't think that much more about it. But for you, it was different when it came to the sound of your own voice.
Yeah, well, maybe in radio. I guess you record what you do and you hear it back. But, you know, as a recording artist, there are times, you know, you're walking into a record store and people are lined up to, you know, you're going to sign autographs on your latest release and it's blasting over the sound system and you're trying to give your attention to the people who want to autograph and that, but you're in the back of your mind going, Jesus, oh man, who do you think you're fooling with that? And you know, it's really based on the fact that I'm keenly aware of Ray Charles, you know, his records. It's like, man, why can't I bring it like Ray Charles?
Right.
Or
right.
Aretha Franklin or Don Everly, take your pick. Now, having said that, these many years later, you know, where I sit today, the record that you mentioned, Texas, that I've just finished, man, I'm singing like a bird on that record, and I'm proud of it.
Huh. Given a choice, though, if you could just write songs and not do the performing and the singing, would that be your choice?
I would be happy with that. You know, I've also written a memoir. I'm I'm really a split personality in a couple of ways. One is that I'm an extrovert and I love performing. You know, despite the fact that for a while I hated my voice, I loved being in front of people. But I also really enjoy the monastic existence of a writer, which is getting up, you know, having a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and working early in the day, working up into mid-afternoon solo on songs or, you know, putting words on paper. I enjoy it. I thrive in that setting. And I thrive on a stage. The only mark against getting on stage is that you got to get your body around the world, and that gets old after a while. So to answer your question, I would be happy really living the life of a writer alone.
I'm visiting with the great Rodney Crowell. You know, you've talked when it comes to writing songs about the importance of maintaining this work ethic that you just referred to. You got to keep working at it every day. That's sort of your view, like a novelist going, like we've had John Grisham in here. He goes to work every day, you know, writes until noon or two, and he's got to do that to feel good about the day.
Well, you've got to do that to get anything done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great written works are, you know, what Truman Capote says, great books are not written, they are rewritten.
Yes.
And which requires you get up and get back to work the next day. But I'll tell you, you know, early on in my 20s, I was luckily the recipient of, you know, bolts of lightning in the form of inspiration, in which I wrote songs in my early 20s that are still performed today.
Mm-hmm.
But as time went on, I realized, you know, when it comes to inspiration, at some point, some nearly invisible point along the way, it switches over from, you know, God or the universe or the keepers of inspiration giving you big bolts of inspiration when you're young. Eventually you have to earn it.
Mm-hmm.
And where I am now and have been for, you know, 20 plus years is I, you know, fully realize that for me to get inspiration, I'm going to have to get back to work every day. Because I'm pretty sure whoever's watching over how much inspiration you get is really checking the work ethic day in and day out.
You know, I love this story about you because you've told this before, this notion that you used to sit down with Guy Clark and he would look you right in the eye and he would say, "Don't play it to me, just say it to me. And while you're doing that, look me right dead in the eye." And you've said that taught you a whole lot about how to construct a song all the way through. How so?
Well, first of all, if you don't know Guy Clark, you have to imagine is like, you know, a bald eagle looking into the eyes of a bald eagle, that stern and all wise. Early on, Guy and I would sit and listen to Dylan Thomas reading his poetry, you know, and Guy would go on about it. He said, "Our songs have to be able to stand alone as language like that." And somehow we fell into, okay, look me in the eye and recite to me what you just were singing. And in that case, you know, if you've got a really weak line that doesn't belong in the song or a really bad couplet, when you look at somebody like that, that audience of one, and you want to turn, you know, avert your gaze as you're delivering the line, then you know you need to elbow that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I teach songwriting workshops occasionally, every couple of years, and, you know, when the students come in, you know, and I suggest we do that, you can see the fear in their eyes.
Yeah. I bet that's right. Well, speaking of language.
It's a truth serum.
Yeah, no, I get that. I totally get that. Speaking of language, again, you've said that you know the honky-tonk clientele, the construction workers, the East Houston truck drivers, construction workers, electricians. You knew that as part of your growing up. How much does that help when it comes to pulling out the right word and connecting with people?
Well, in terms of colloquial vernacular. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, I work construction, you know, all through high school, summer times, and then early into college, you know, I was working heavy construction, and I worked with a Cajun contingency, you know, coming over from Louisiana, and their language is really colorful. So when it, you know, when it comes time to create a song that will resonate with your listener, and I try not to be regional, but sometimes if you get it right regionally, sometimes it's going to bleed over into globally. I've had success with songs that were specifically aimed at those construction workers. Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up there. I never specifically aim a song at anything other than what it, I let it tell me it wants to be. But, I mean, it's just so colorful. I mean, I wrote a song called Bull Rider that Johnny Cash recorded. Mm-hmm. And he made a beautiful record of it. But, you know, there was a time in my youth when I was a wannabe bull rider. I got on a few bulls and went to some youth rodeos. And the language around the rodeo is very poetic, as it is in the garage of NASCAR. There's a, I wrote a song about Richard Petty basically using all of the slang vernacular. You know, when somebody's really getting, you know, driving fast on the track, they say he's got his boot in his gas tank. Now, that's a metaphor, but, it, you know, and I use that, you know, you got your boot in your gas tank. It means you're going fast. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That kind of, picking up on that kind of thing is vital to writing songs for me.
What's it like having, I know you had a family connection at one point to Johnny Cash, but what's it like having Johnny Cash record one of your songs?
Well, John Prine said it's like hearing Abraham Lincoln sing.
I like and, that.
You know,
I like
yeah, that. It worked like that. And, you know, he was my father-in-law for 13 years, and then we became good friends. Mm-hmm. We were good friends before, but early on, I was a young kid coming up, you know, just getting some songs out and into the world, trying to make my way. And I fell in, you know, with his oldest daughter, and we had got married, had kids. But for a while there, I was a little bit of a punk trying to establish my position. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, hey, I'm my own man, Mr. Man in Black. And it was kind of it was kind of pathetic and silly, but he had a sense of humor about it. He was really
good.
I think he enjoyed it. He was like, look at this kid trying to impress me with his street cred. I got so much street cred, I could wipe him out of here in a heartbeat.
Well, Rodney Crowell and his acoustic trio will perform at the Folly Theater at 8 o'clock Friday evening as part of the Bridges Americana series. Tickets are at follytheater.org. Let's listen to some more Rodney Crowell, and this is Shame on the Moon Redux from his 2018 album Acoustic Classics, and it's a song that Bob Seger made famous.
Well, it wasn't all that long ago that I could really drink 'em down. 3 days up and running wild and never touched the ground. If tall, dark, and handsome is not what I am, you've either not noticed or you don't give a damn. Well, I've heard it said 1,000 times, to thine own self be true. But it's not for lack of trying that this is something I can't do. So what can I tell you that you don't already know? Chinks in my armor are starting to show.
Ooh, blame it on midnight. Ooh.
That's Rodney Crowell. You know, you rewrote the last verse of that song when you re-recorded it for this album. Bob Seger told you to leave it alone.
Au contraire.
Why did you want to redo it?
Oh, I rewrote the whole song.
The whole
thing? Not just the thing of, here's the backstory on that, and a lot of people differ with me, but when I was, the inspiration came to write that song, I had the TV on. Yeah, I lived in L.A., and the Jimmy Jones Massacre came on while, you know, the TV was down low, and I was strumming the guitar and writing words down, and I got distracted by the news, and the last verse was just not up to snuff. But I went ahead and recorded it because I was getting ready to make an album, and it turned out well, and Bob learned it off my album, and he had a huge hit. And he sang this. After I heard it, I rang him up and said, well, you know what? You own this song forever. I mean, you just sang it so well. I'm not going to perform that song because that's the definitive version of it. But I was always displeased with the language on the last verse, and I tinkered with it for 30 years. And then finally, when I was making this acoustic classics, which is acoustic versions of, you know, my bigger songs,
right,
most of my bigger songs, some of them, it finally dawned on me. I said, I've been trying to rewrite the last verse, and what I need to do is just rewrite the entire song. It gives me an opportunity to do it. So I just rewrote the whole thing, and I prefer the original version of me singing it. But I much prefer the language that is in the song now. It's far more solid for me.
Your buddy, Emmylou Harris, says that's typical Rodney Crowell because she calls you a perfectionist. Are you?
No.
No?
No. I mean, I've been called perfectionist, and I bristle at that because the one thing I know in art, it's never perfect. And really, things that are perfect, you know, it's the connotation of perfect to me means the juice is gone. It ain't sexy and it's not fun. And, you know, no.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a perfectionist, but I really do know my work. And you know, to think that I would spend that many years chasing something, you know, blindly would be, you know, Emmy's wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm not a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm.
Just know what I'm doing.
I mentioned in the opening that you're doing this new Texas album with Willie and Lyle Lovett and Steve Earle. This is an album of collaborations, and it'll be released in August. Just guessing here, that was probably a lot of fun to do.
Was. I was corresponding with somebody this morning about, I said, you know, I just followed the fun on this. And actually, the collaboration started with Steve Earle and I, because Steve had performed this song that I'd written way back in the 70s, and we talked for years and years about, well, we need to record that. And we finally got around to it, and the Ringo Starr thing just came about because of a mutual friend had been trying to get us together to write a song for one of Ringo's albums, and it just so happened that I got a note back saying, hey, Ringo's available for drumming if you want it.
Huh.
And then the Billy Gibbons collaboration, you know, from ZZ Top, he's from Houston like me, and we're about the same age, and we've talked for years about back and forth about what if we came up with something. So
yeah.
It just, the record really made itself. I didn't really, at the start of it, I didn't think, well, I'm going to make a record of collaborations, but that's what it became, you know, paint by numbers, and there it is.
Yeah, I'm just curious, when you're with someone like Ringo Starr, how do other artists regard him when, like, they meet him for the first time? I mean, he was a Beatle, and does that still have that magic attached to it?
Of course. You know, I first met Ringo in 1976 in London, stayed up, you know, at the old Hyde Park Hotel one night, and with an all-night party, and Ringo didn't remember it. I remembered it, but Ringo didn't remember it. But, you know, most recently when I was out at his place recording, he's a smart man, and he's really gentle and kind. And, you know, the thing about peace, baby,
yes.
I mean, that's real yes. with him.
Yeah.
And a sweetheart of a guy, really intelligent, vulnerable, and, you know, lovable. Mm. You mm. know, he was always the lovable Beatle, and that's there's a good reason for that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a hell of a drummer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like to do this with artists like yourself, Rodney. Let me run down some of the folks you've worked with and just give me a couple thoughts real quickly on some of these folks that people are always so interested in. Linda Ronstadt.
Linda Ronstadt, really a sweetheart, and especially when I was closer to her, maybe she was in her late 20s and really coming into her own, becoming a big star. And really, a really great conversationalist mm. and listened very closely in conversation. It was like she wasn't in her own world, like, look at me. She was present. With Linda, I would say very present.
That's great. How about Willie Nelson?
Willie is funny. He's got a really wicked sense of humor, and he's able to deliver it with six words or less. And it's, you know, the old thing about the soul of wit, brevity.
Is right.
The soul of wit.
Right.
Willie Nelson.
There you go. How about one more? Emmy Lou Harris. You've made a couple of albums with her.
Angelic, inspired. And she inspires loyalty. Mm-hmm. Because Emmy Lou is the most loyal human being I know. I mean, loyal to the marrow. I mean, if you're her friend or someone she cares about, her loyalty is fierce and it's infectious. And people who love her with that same kind of loyalty.
Well, again, Rodney Crowell performs at the Folly Theater 8 o'clock Friday night as part of the Bridges Americana series. For tickets, follytheater.org. You know, it's been a pleasure, Rodney. I just really enjoy talking to you, and I hope you have
a good
visit to Kansas City. We'll see you Friday night, okay?
I will have a good time, man. Thank you.
You bet. Let's go out with one more Rodney Crowell original. This is It's Such a Small World from his 88 album, Diamonds and Dirt. This one features Roseanne Cash, his wife at the time.
Come around but once in a while. This is such a surprise.
I'm Steve Kraske. We'll see you tomorrow, and you are up to date.
It's been a long time since you crossed my mind. It's such a small